Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. And on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. In Raul Palma's debut novel, A Haunting in Hialeah Gardens, Hugo Carrera has lost his wife to illness and gotten in return an impossible medical debt that can never be repaid because of its soaring interest rates. When his arch nemesis, the debt collector, Alexi Ramirez, calls him out of the blue, it's for spiritual rather than capital reasons. Alexi senses that his property in Hialeah Gardens, overdone in ostentatious wealth, is suffused with an ill spirit, a ghost of his first debt collection, and he is turning to Hugo for a different set of skills. Hugo works at a botanica in a strip mall for a spiritual medium named Lourdes. He is a babalao, capable, supposedly, of clearing bad spirits. When a contract is made promising the clearing of his debts in return for a clean bill of spiritual health at Alexi's house, Hugo sets about on what he thinks is a purely imagined exorcism. What he finds is a haunting of his own, that pulls together the death of his wife, his unsettled connection to the Latin community in Miami, and a longer history of his childhood in Bolivia, working in the silver mines. A devil that bears the signs of colonial occupation, capitalist racism, and immigrant struggle has been raised and is up to Hugo to clear a different kind of debt. Told in alternately hilarious and frightening prose, A Haunting in Hialeah Gardens is a masterwork of suspense, genre play, and a novel that belongs to the rich history of literature that opens up Miami's immigrant story to allow new voices, new faces, and new ideas to come storming in. A truly impressive debut. Raul Palma is a second-generation Cuban-American born and raised in Miami. His short story collection, In This World of Ultraviolet Light, won the 2021 Don Belton Prize. His writing has appeared in Alaska Quarterly Review, the Greensboro Review, Hayden Ferry Review, and elsewhere. He teaches fiction at Ithaca College, where he is the Associate Dean of the Faculty in the School of Humanities and Sciences. He has also taught at the Elmira Correctional Facility through Cornell University's Prison Education Program. He lives with his wife and daughter in Ithaca, New York. Welcome to Burned by Books, Raul.
Hey, thank you. And thanks for that introduction.
Well, this is a really magnificent novel, and it's both fun and heady. And a lot of your previous short fiction work takes place in Miami and works often specifically with Cuban diaspora communities there. But how did you end up wanting to write a novel about exorcisms in a very particular community just on the edge of Miami?
That's a great question. It's actually every year around the holidays, I sit down with Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol and read through it, and it's kind of become a tradition for me. Right. And very early on when I started working on this project, because I was in such close proximity to debt, I began to draw these really interesting connections with Dickens, the Carol. And I think the bend toward Gothic probably began there. Right. But it really began to accelerate for me when I began to start thinking or imagining these larger associations between Latin America's colonial past and then this kind of surface level Miami in which everybody's just kind of going to work, making a living or living in big mansions. And what I wanted to do was try to figure out a way that I could kind of pierce that everyday from point A to point B life for the characters in the novel. And it seemed that the possibility of a kind of exorcism or haunting would be a good vehicle for that. So it began with that kind of playful nature, and then I just kind of leaned into it.
And Hialeah Gardens is, I think it's technically a city, but I think it's really thought of as part of Metro Miami. What makes Hialeah unique, and especially in its relationship to a Cuban diaspora there? And why was it important to set an exorcism there?
So absolutely, right? Hialeah proper is kind of maybe what most folks would think about when they're thinking about the Cuban diaspora. Kind of in central north Miami, one of 27 municipalities that make up Miami proper.
Oh, I didn't realize there was that many.
Right. It's kind of amazing, right? That when we reference Miami, we're also referencing all of these little small, tiny cities. Hialeah is one of the larger ones. And then Hialeah Gardens is just outside of it in this really unique geographical position. It's kind of in between Hialeah, a city called Medley, which is kind of an industrial city where there are landfills, cement manufacturers, casting, that kind of thing. And then just north of it, a city called Miami Lakes, which kind of borders Broward County and Miramar and those areas. So it's kind of right off this main highway, but kind of nestled between these communities. And the kind of place that, especially if you're visiting Miami as a tourist, you wouldn't necessarily, end up in, right? It's kind of north and really west when it comes to Miami. So setting the novel there, what caught my attention was this idea that even out there, close to the Everglades, right, between this industrial community in a small tract of land along a canal and along a highway, that even out there, there are these multi-million dollar homes that are being constructed. Mm-hmm. And I thought, how unusual, right, that a city like Miami just continues to spread out, and that just as a natural kind of response to the pressures with the cost of property and real estate and traffic and things like that, that places like Hialeah Gardens would then flourish, right? So far from the major attractions that most people think about when they're thinking of Miami. So I was kind of fascinated by that, a place that so many possibilities in terms of the folks who live there and the kind of intersections with the industries, but a place that really isn't on most people's radar.
It lives in this peripheral sense of Miami that's not the sort of pop culture understanding of Miami for people who don't live there, but it's you give it life in the novel and make it such a central part of that metro understanding of the city. I want to talk about hauntings in the novel. You read Dickens' A Christmas Carol every year, and my family listens to the 1935 Lionel Barrymore radio program of it, which is pretty amazing. If you haven't listened to it, it is, since you love the story, you will love the radio production of it. It's amazing.
I have to check that out.
And it's sponsored by Campbell's Soup. And so there are commercials, 1935 style commercials that tell housewives that some of their burden can be lifted now that they have Campbell's soups in their home. Yeah, so check it out. But there are many kind of hauntings in this novel. There's the sort of more direct haunting of Alexei and his family, but there's a haunting longing that Hugo has for Melly, his deceased wife. And then there's this historical haunting of both his childhood, but a much longer haunting of colonialism and Spanish conquistadors. And so the idea of unsettled ghosts and spirits that might be seeking revenge ties a thread between these past, present, and perhaps future scales of trauma. Can you discuss these different levels of haunting that you layer in the novel?
Yeah, and I appreciate you kind of just taking a moment to put them in these separate categories, right? Because there is a lot kind of layered on top of, the themes of the novel.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And I think the novel, it kind of opens up gradually. You know, there are certainly a lot of hints at the start of the novel to these other hauntings that are occurring. But the first kind of sense of it that we get, and maybe it's subtle, maybe it's kind of magical, it's this the debt kind of dropping into bed with Hugo in that first paragraph, right? Waking up and cuddling with the debt, and you know, the kinds of things that maybe, you know, people don't want to be thinking about when they're trying to get some sleep. And so it begins there, but even that, I think, doesn't really gain traction early on. What we really see is that Alexei is being haunted. And I think that's the first manifestation, this kind of acute conflict, something that Hugo has to contend with. But what I try to do in the novel is show how all of these hauntings are interconnected in ways that are historical, as you discuss. So if we're tracking onto, let's say, the Christmas Carol, right, we might think of Alexei as the Scrooge, right, who's sitting behind you know, with all his properties or his money, and right,
ravenous, grasping, crotchety.
No, that's right. And so I think if we're catching some of those nods early on, there's a certain expectation that the novel begins to forecast in the way that the haunting is going to proceed. But I think where it begins to turn, it's those moments when Hugo gets home. You know, he's away from Alexei, and now he's thinking about his past with Melly. He's kind of reluctant to go there into his past, both with Melly and his childhood and his time in Bolivia and what that all means. So I see him gradually kind of gaining access, or maybe giving himself permission to, maybe permission is the wrong word, but falling into these hauntings that gradually get him further and further away from that acute conflict with Alexei, and more into some of the things that he's been avoiding all his life. You know, I see his interactions with Alexei as one reviewer, I think, described it beautifully. It's two immigrants negotiating their realities with one another.
That matches really one of my major things that I love about the novel, and that is the way in which you open up the possibility of very different immigrant experiences in Miami. And Miami gets reduced to, when we're thinking about Spanish-speaking immigrants, Cuba only, highly successful, integrated in all the senses of that word, anti-communist, Trump-supporting. But a hunting in Hialeah Gardens presents much more textured, diverse, and complicated ways of living, being successful, being happy, and what it means to count as a Spanish-speaking immigrant in Miami. And take us through a little bit about your sense of how maybe our general population in the U.S. reduces that experience and how you wanted to expand it.
Yeah, and you know, it's the general population. I think even in Miami, it gets reduced.
Really? Oh, that's so interesting.
You know, because there's a sense, you know, as somebody who grew up in Miami, sometimes it happens to me, especially because I live up north. Sometimes I'll reflect back on the city, or I'll visit, and I expect a very particular kind of Miami. You know, the Miami from my high school days or my early college days, right? And the city really has expanded and changed so much within the last decade. It's this rising global city, this major, it's becoming a really major regional financial center for Latin America, much more than in previous years. And what we're seeing in Miami is this influx of folks from all over the world, for Art Basel, for you name it, right? And I think that idea of Miami kind of being separated into just maybe a few immigrant groups, some that dominate and some that don't, has become a lot more complicated recently. And especially with second and third generation of Cuban Americans and other Latinx folks living in Miami. So with the novel, what I wanted to do was imagine, or kind of give shape to, a Miami that is a bit closer to some of the really kind of fantastic cultural negotiations and that are occurring right now in Miami. And it was for that reason that I chose the protagonist, I wanted him to be non-Cuban.
Mm-mm.
You know, I knew that early on, and I wanted him to be Latinx but non-Cuban, and kind of looking at this, what would be the dominant Cuban-American community, but from a position of somebody that's used to looking at it from the outside, right? As a way to kind of give vision to parts of the city that maybe sometimes folks don't immediately go to when they're thinking about it, even those who live in Miami.
Yeah, that's, well, it's so fascinating to me the way in which Hugo and then Alexi sort of become these kind of foils for one another, but also begin to open up in each other. This kind of different ways of being and belonging that don't fall into those understandable categories. One of the things I love about this book is it's hilarious. It's filled with incredible Black comedy about everything, you know, everything from, you know, traffic to death to the devil to, and I'm just wondering how you work with comedy in your fiction when it's brushing up against real things, real historical and present terror and trauma.
With this novel in particular, it was really important to bring some humor in. And I think, you know, just kind of putting myself inside of Hugo's head for a moment, you know, he's somebody who, you know, everything is kind of contained for him. He's living this very claustrophobic life. And when it comes to agency, there are few real choices he can make because of the sorts of debts that he has, right? But I'm really interested in these kind of adjacent spaces where you can find that agency or find that power, right? And I think humor is one of them. Opportunities. So even if you're in a situation that's quite bleak, right? One adjacent space is, you know, you can crack a joke about it, right? Or mm-hmm. laugh about it. And I think, and there are other categories like that, like dreams, right? The ability, even if you're contained in a space, to be able to dream and imagine your way out or dream your way out, you know. So part of the humor is kind of a survival mechanism, the way I picture it for Hugo. But it's also coming from the narrator, right? And it was, you know, as the narrative unfolds, right? Because it touches on so many difficult topics, it felt really important to bring in some humor as well, right? And to those moments where it kind of affirms the life of the characters in the novel, right? And shows that it's not just people who are damned and going through the motions, but rather people who find themselves in these beautiful life-affirming moments while simultaneously living, you know, in these bleak circumstances.
Yeah, yeah. What are the ways that you convey comedy in the novel is through Spanish and often profanities in Spanish. you run the full gambit, including some that I didn't know, which was really fun. And there's a connected thing with your use of Spanish and its untranslated status in the novel. It works in context, for sure, but it works differently if you know in Spanish that basura encendida is, you know, trash fire. and it's going to be funnier and more specific. So can you talk about the richness of having that double audience and double meaning happening, and how you like to play with also the richness of profanity?
Oh, it's really fun, you know, because I guess I set out writing the novel with a kind of implied audience, and the implied audience being, I guess, folks in Miami, right, who are really intimate with the city and know it really well. And I think I began there in early drafts, and then, of course, began to think about larger audiences in revision, right? And it's fascinating, right? Particularly with some of the Spanish, there are clear moments when somebody who doesn't speak Spanish, right, might miss something the nuance maybe of a particular phrase, right? While, as you said, somebody who knows it would catch it right away, right? And that itself was fascinating, right? You know, I tried not to overdetermine some of it and try to, what is it, cultivate the experience for various readers. And what I chose to do later in revision stages was to kind of lean into this beautiful linguistic, you know, complication, right, that comes with folks who are from Miami, who think in Spanish but speak in English and throw in some Spanish, right, as a way of, staging some of that on the page, right, and seeing what these words and what these phrases alongside one another can elicit or produce. But there are often a lot of like fun opportunities with that. And I guess just to dig into it a bit further, right, it's a place too where this idea of having access or being able to enter into a community or enter into a system, right, there are ways in which Miami, of course, closes some people out based on wealth or based on where you live or the way you appear. But I think it occurs sometimes at the level of the language too, without folks fully realizing it. So it was fun to stage that and allow that tension to exist there.
Yeah, I love the way that you talk about the complications and beauty of the complexity of having Spanish just operating, both in the way people are thinking and the way that they're speaking. And you really get a sense of that in Hugo and the other characters. I want to talk a little bit about the way that this novel is obsessed with different kinds of debt and indebtedness. And Hugo's debt that rises from the dead when Mellie dies is such an indictment of capitalism and its use of debt to keep people immobilized and keep them from ever climbing out from underneath these kind of weighty debts that just grow and grow because of interest. And so that becomes, in a way, tied. There's a thread that gets tied to that ghost of the past and colonialism and the way that debts were and indebtedness was accrued during that period. So could you talk a little bit about the connection between the two and how you wanted to think about that kind of terrible indebtedness that so many Americans and specifically immigrant Americans have on their shoulders?
You know, when I started writing the novel, I think my approach toward debt was very two-dimensional. You know, it was, I was really thinking about credit cards, student loans, you know, and the fun of this novel. You know, of course, something felt off, incomplete, and in approaching those topics. And the fun of the novel was actually, as you suggested, right, digging a lot deeper into these topics, right? And from my position right now with a novel out in the world, you know, debt fundamentally, I see it as this kind of primordial, you know, obligation, responsibility that we have to one another in a society, right? The idea that we can run into each other on the street, run into a stranger somewhere, right? In a community, in a society, right? And for there to be peace, right? To say hello, to walk by, right? For there not to be violence that occurs, right? You know, this debt that we have to one another, even without knowing one another, to maintain a certain peace, a society. And then, so I, from my position, I begin there and you know, just kind of thinking about the ways in which debts kind of get mapped on or sutured on to capitalism, to finance, you know, to the ways in which these sorts of obligations that we have to one another, which are beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. Also now can be compounded with interest, right? Can be levied by the, you know, judicial bodies. And all of a sudden, you know, we've got these systems that are, I think, complicating, in some cases polluting what it is that really holds us together as a people. So in the novel, the way that I wanted to explore that, it had, and that's what took me to Bolivia. It's Potosi, the silver, right? The way that it funded in large part the Industrial Revolution. You know, the way that you know, casually, I was just in Key West in a treasure seeker museum, right? And there was silver everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so interesting.
It was fascinating. And so, so the way that through these colonial efforts, right, essentially Europe can dig this massive hole in South America, can accrue this incredible violence, right? And then off the heels of that, develop industry and commerce and capitalism, accelerate it. I thought that was fascinating. Something that I hadn't seen a lot of people writing about. So I wanted to dig into that and just make apparent, make present the ways in which those histories live in our present.
One of the things that you're doing with that past is you're bringing it, drawing it into the present and making it something that we can feel. And I think the way that you're describing our indebtedness to each other then gets this other layer of unaccounted for indebtedness to each other. And Hugo begins, I think, to sort of feel that. It's not just that he remembers it, he feels it. And this is a novel in which I think sometimes the genre elements of it, feeling that there's an ill spirit and feeling like you're being haunted, has to do with kind of feeling these indebtedness to others. And I wonder if that affect, that feeling those things, has something to do with how you play with the genre of spirits and exorcisms, etc.
Yeah, thank you. The genres, I guess the way that I'm accessing them, it's often in conversation with other writers, right, who happen to work within particular genres. And with this novel in particular, I think one of the comments that I hear sometimes from readers is that, you know, it's a page turner, right? It's got like, I think of it as a narrative that has like this engine in which, you know, there's this need to flip the page and get to the next one and get to the next one. And there's a desire to arrive at the end and find out what happens, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that sometimes is part of what people are thinking about when they're thinking about genre. Not always, but I think it's sometimes associated with it. But it's also something that, especially in the context of debt and in the novel, something that I'm cautious about as well, something that I'm sometimes skeptical about. You know, if I find myself, you know, as an example, going to the mailbox and opening up a catalog from like a retailer or something and flipping through it and being like, I want to buy all of that. Right. Or I don't know, these ways in which, you know, you could find yourself valuing a certain way of being in the world in which, you know, there are things that you want and things that you need to possess, right, or own, and I think that sometimes genre can work that way in the way that the narrative functions. So I have a complicated relationship with these kind of page turner models or these narratives that function this way. So part of the challenge with a novel was, and in subverting that a little bit, was figuring out, okay, you know, there are certain ways in which this is going to absolutely latch onto these traditional plots and genre and that kind of thing, but there need to be ways that the novel turns away from it as well. You know, there need to be ways in which, you know, at the moment that you know, you're going to finally possess the object of desire or something like that, you know, things kind of flip and it wasn't what was expected.
Yeah, the novel is suspicious of its own genres.
Yeah, I love it put that way.
And that I think imbues it with that page turning quality, because it's like, well, I want to figure out what the novel thinks of itself. Is it serious about this thing? Is it serious about this other thing? And for me, it turns out it's serious about most of them. But it still wants to complicate them and say, yes, but. And that I think does a lot of good work for how the genres exist in the book. Before I let you go, I'd love to know a little bit about what you've been reading recently and whether you have some things you'd like to recommend for our listeners.
So on my way back from Paris, I opened up my friend Alejandro Nodadze, his book. It's a thriller. It's called Blood in the Cut. He's a fellow Nebraskan Cuban American. We met in Nebraska.
So there are two of you. That's
yeah. There are two. Right. And he's debuting now. It's in April, I believe. So I tore through 100 pages and then came here this week to through college for work, and I'm getting ready this weekend to spend some more time with it. But it's been a lot of fun. It's kind of, it kind of opens up. It's got like a great, it's got a Grapes of Wrath feel. With a protagonist kind of coming back to the family after having spent some time in prison. Right. And then it kind of quickly, maybe it was because I'd just been on the plane and I'd just seen the Gucci movie, House of Gucci. Right. It's got that vibe, right. With a Lady Gaga character, who's kind of intent and kind of revamping things and getting creative.
It sounds outrageously good.
Yeah. It was hard to walk away from it. So I'm looking forward to getting back to it. The last great book I read, it was, Claire Jimenez's What Happened to Ruthie Ramirez. Mm. She's such a gifted storyteller, awesome voice. I had the pleasure of reading alongside her at the Miami Book Fair recently.
Oh, awesome.
It was fantastic. So that's for now. I'm planning in the next week or so, I'll be reading a little bit about kind of Miami rising sea levels, various articles and books on that. But
that's right. That is that gives us a hint of where your next novel's going, doesn't it? Well, we'll have that to look forward to. And I love the Claire Jimenez novel, and I can't wait for Blood in the Cut. But everyone should run out to their local indie bookstore and get A Haunting in Hialeah Gardens by Raul Palma. You will not be disappointed. And it was certainly such a pleasure to get to talk to you, Raul. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
All right, likewise. Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. No, your questions are incredible.
Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to the fabulous Raul Palma for coming on the show to talk about his blockbuster debut novel, A Haunting in Hialeah Gardens. You can find links to purchase A Haunting in Hialeah Gardens and all of Raul's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.